Faith Hedgepeth was a 19-year-old undergraduate in her third year at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 2012. A member of the Halawasaponi Native American tribe, she dreamed of being the first member of her family to graduate from college and was looking to pursue a career in education or medicine. She was intelligent and beautiful, the kind of person that people just gravitated towards. She had a bubbly personality and possessed a special skill when it came to making people laugh. Faith took the spring semester off in 2012, and during the summer moved into an off-campus apartment with her best friend, Karina Rosario. She had plans to go back to classes in the fall. At the time, Faith lived with Rosario and her boyfriend, Eric Tekoi Jones, a controlling and violent man. When things turned bad between he and Rosario, Faith worked hard to help her friend through the struggle. Jones eventually moved out, though he didn't go far, and Faith helped Rosario acquire an order of protection against him. Jones felt that Faith was working against him and broke into the apartment on several occasions, and on at least one of these occasions, he threatened to kill Faith if things between he and Rosario didn't work out. By September, the situation appeared to have quieted down, and Faith was back in class, working hard to get her grades up to where she wanted them to be after taking a semester off. On the evening of September 6th, she attended a rush event for a Native American sorority and then went to the library with her roommate, Rosario. The two left around midnight, stopped back at their apartment, and then went to a local bar known as The Thrill. Surveillance cameras captured the two women leaving the bar an hour later, around 2 a.m., in the company of a handful of men, though they would arrive back at their apartment alone. A series of strange texts and phone calls occurred shortly after 3 a.m., with Faith texting Brandon Edwards, trying to entice him to come over and visit with Rosario. Rosario herself was calling him at the same time, though Edwards wouldn't answer until the next afternoon. When she struck out with Edwards, Rosario contacted Jordan McCrary, a soccer player at Chapel Hill, who swung by and picked her up at approximately 4:25 a.m. on September 7th. According to Rosario, when she left the apartment, Faith was asleep inside. She did not lock the apartment door. The next morning, Rosario needed a ride home and placed several calls to Faith, who failed to answer. Finally, Marisol Rangel, a mutual friend of both Rosario and Faith, came by to drive her back to the apartment. At 11 a.m., Rosario entered and found a bloodbath. Faith had been sexually assaulted and brutally bludgeoned to death with an empty bottle of Bacardi. Her body was discovered in the bedroom, partially undressed and covered in blood. Rosario screamed and immediately dialed 911. Police arrived on the grisly scene and immediately began investigating the homicide, taking many items from the apartment. They eventually retrieved male DNA from multiple places in the apartment, from the Bacardi bottle, and in the form of a rape kit. A note was also found at the scene, apparently left by the killer, but who was the note left for? Police began looking into all possible suspects, including but not limited to the men Faith had spoken to at the Thrill, men she had exchanged text messages with, as well as Eric Tekoi Jones. Jones was quickly their prime suspect, having threatened Faith in the past and due to strange messages he posted on social media in the hours leading up to her murder. Unfortunately, the DNA they recovered from the crime scene failed to match any potential suspects, and they were left struggling to find out who could have committed such a brutal murder. The FBI came in and conducted a profile on the killer, alleging that he had likely lived near Faith at some point, would be obsessed with and talk about the case a lot, and would have expressed interest in Faith while she had still been alive. The suspect list was slowly narrowed down until everyone they came across had been thoroughly investigated and cleared through DNA comparison. Desperate for answers, they sent their samples out to a lab who were able to create a digital composite of what the killer may look like through phenotyping. They determined that he was of Latino origin, had dark hair and brown or hazel eyes. His image was shown to friends and family, but none could think of anyone who matched the composite. In the aftermath of the murder, Faith's best friend Karina Rosario withdrew from the public, refusing to give interviews, though since the murder, She has been questioned by police over 10 times, leading many to believe she knows more than she's saying. Several years after the murder, a voicemail was released in which, on the night she died, Faith had accidentally dialed a friend. Though it's incredibly difficult to make out, certain parts can be understood. It appears to depict a violent situation between Faith, two men, and another woman. Several times Faith can be heard calling for help. Police dismiss this call, saying that the timestamp shows she was at the bar during this time. Others have argued that the timestamp could be wrong, and that the voicemail may have been left during her murder. Who murdered Faith Hedgepeth, and for what reason? Did a complete stranger happen upon her unlocked apartment and choose to attack without a motive? Did someone from Faith's past who felt wronged make the decision to strike back? Did Eric Takoy Jones finally find a way to fulfill his promise? Or did Faith's best friend and roommate, Karina Rosario, play a much more vital role in Faith's final hours? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 23, The Murder of Faith Hedgepeth. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode looks into the brutal murder of 19-year-old Faith Hedgepeth in September of 2012. It's a terribly sad story with a violent end and no answers in sight. Her family are desperate for justice, and the police are frustrated with the lack of development in her case. Before moving into the details, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on missing persons and unsolved murders. We are available across multiple platforms, and we're on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and many more. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. It can be found at patreon.com/traceevidence. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you enjoy it and wish to help support it, please check out the Patreon page. I've also set up a one-time PayPal donation link on the main website for those of you who wish to contribute but don't want to use Patreon. Links, information, and more items, including YouTube videos and full episode transcripts, can be found on the website at trace-evidence.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Tweet me at traceevpod, that's TRACEEVPOD. Add me on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence Podcast or clicking the direct link on our website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. And as a final note, if you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews we get, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to these cases. Today I look into the murder of Faith Hedgepeth, a brilliant and beautiful woman who was stolen from the world far too soon. The details of her final hours take us through the normal life of a college girl before transforming into a grisly murder for which no one can find a true motive. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 23, The Murder of Faith Hedgepeth. Faith Danielle Hedgepeth was born on September 26, 1992, in Warren County, North Carolina. She was a member of the Halawa Saponi Native American tribe, born to Roland and his wife Connie. Roland described his daughter as driven to succeed. Faith was their third daughter, and according to Connie, she named her Faith because that is exactly what she would need to be able to raise a third child, considering that, between her other two teenage daughters, one was already married and the other was struggling with substance abuse issues. Faith was predominantly raised by her mother, who was assisted by her older sister, Rolanda, who acted as a second mother. Friends described Faith as the kind of girl who was always smiling, a very social woman who had no problem making friends. Michael Irvin said this of Faith, quote, "I feel like she spent a lot of time caring for others and not as much for herself. Some of our conversations were about things she was going through or was trying to figure out how to handle. She seemed to kind of put her stuff to the side," end quote. While attending high school, Faith became an honors student. She was also a cheerleader and was heavily involved in extracurricular activities and a member of several school organizations and clubs. Her academics were impressive enough that she was granted a Gates Millennium Scholarship, which was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and is awarded to students who demonstrate academic excellence and show strong leadership skills. Students must maintain a 3.3 GPA and be active in community service, among other extracurricular activities, to be considered. Faith dreamed of becoming a doctor and left her tribal community to attend UNC Chapel Hill, with the assistance of her scholarship, in hopes of achieving her dream and of one day coming home to help with her people. Asked later about his daughter, Roland would state, quote, "She was developing into a remarkable young woman. At the same time, she still had the heart of a child. She was very trusting, probably naive in some ways because of that." End quote. Roland had attended UNC Chapel Hill, but he had dropped out, and Faith was excited and focused on becoming the first member of her family to graduate from college. During her time at Chapel Hill, she excelled, as was expected of someone of her intensity and intellect. Though she began to debate whether or not she wished to pursue a career as a pediatrician or possibly become a teacher. For the first 2 years Faith attended Chapel Hill, things seemed to be going according to plan. She was working hard and doing well at her studies, but somewhere along the way, things changed. Faith would take off the spring semester of 2012, and now 19 years old, she would stay in Chapel Hill, living in off-campus housing. She got an apartment with Karina Rosario, a girl who she had met during her freshman year and had become very close friends with. Rosario's boyfriend, Eric Takoy Jones, also lived with them. The three lived together at the Hawthorne at the View apartment complex, located between Chapel Hill and Durham, though times were not necessarily positive. Rosario and Jones had a volatile relationship with several alleged instances of domestic violence resulting in Rosario ending the relationship and Jones leaving the apartment, but not going very far. He moved into another apartment in the same complex. Many have indicated that drugs were involved in the amping up of the anger between the two, with Jones having been arrested for possession of drug paraphernalia on April 27th. Fearful of Jones, Rosario changed the locks on their apartment, though this didn't stop him from attempting to break in on two separate occasions and succeeding at least once. According to Faith and Rosario, Jones had kicked two doors off their hinges in the apartment, entered the bedroom, and threw Rosario down to the ground, threatening her. Things continued to tread downhill, and Faith ended up driving Rosario to a court appearance during which she got a protective order against Jones. The order was granted in a Durham County court on July 11th. Allegedly, Jones didn't appreciate Faith getting involved. He believed that Faith had convinced Rosario to get the restraining order, and he held her personally responsible for the state of their relationship. According to some sources, during a phone call with Faith, Jones threatened to kill her if things didn't work out between he and Rosario. I've also read that this was not a phone call with Faith, but a statement that Jones had made directly to Rosario. Everything would change on Thursday, September 6, 2012. This would be the last night that Faith was seen alive. Police have constructed an official timeline, and I will follow the details of it in order to illustrate her comings and goings from that night. Faith had rejoined UNC Chapel Hill that fall, and was once again attending classes. The early part of her day was fairly normal, with her attending classes, hanging out with friends, and talking to her family. Around 5:45 p.m., Faith arrived at the Shadowwood Apartments for a rush event led by UNC's chapter of the Alpha Pi Omega Sorority, a Native American sorority. Faith showed up early, but wasn't quite sure where the apartment was in which the event was being held. Unsure of her destination, she waited in her Nissan Altima until Victoria Chavez arrived, a junior who was good friends with Faith. Faith left the event around 7:15 p.m., telling friends that she had a paper she needed to complete. At the time, she was working on a major project in which she was discussing the history of her tribe. Since she had taken the spring semester off, Faith had a lot of catching up to do in order to raise her academics back to where they had once been. Sometime after leaving the event, Faith met up with Rosario and the two headed for UNC's Davis Library, arriving at approximately 7:30 p.m. During her time at the library, Faith exchanged several text messages with her father. According to Roland, he was dealing with some personal issues at the time, and Faith seemed to instinctively know. Roland stated, quote, "She asked me what's wrong. I don't know how she knew I was right in the middle of a crisis. We texted back and forth, and the last thing she told me was, 'Just have faith, Daddy. I promise it'll work out.' I just thought, I'll call her tomorrow. And tomorrow never came, of course." End quote. Faith also texted with Chavez. The two discussed joining the Alpha Pi Omega sorority, but nothing more substantial. Their conversation ended when they made plans to get together that weekend. Chavez received her final text from Faith at 9:03 p.m., according to her phone records. Police have also said that at some point, Faith left the library to go to the apartment of a male friend. "I've been unable to recover a name, though investigators don't see a connection between this man and Faith's case." She returned later, meeting back up with Rosario. Faith and Rosario left the library around midnight and made their way back to the apartment they shared. The two left the apartment sometime later and arrived at a Chapel Hill bar called The Thrill at approximately 1 a.m. The Thrill sold liquor but admitted people over 18 for the purpose of dancing and hanging out. At the bar, they met up with several people. It has been alleged that Eric Tekoi Jones was present at The Thrill that night, but police have stated he was not, though they will not reveal his whereabouts at that time. Around an hour later, Rosario claimed that she wasn't feeling well and asked Faith to take her home. Club security cameras captured footage of the two leaving at 2:06 a.m., and this is the last corroborated evidence of Faith's whereabouts that night. According to police, Faith and Rosario arrived back at their apartment sometime before 3 a.m. A downstairs neighbor at their apartment complex reported hearing three thumping noises, which she compared to the sound of a heavy bag being dropped or furniture being turned over. Shortly after this, Faith's Facebook page was accessed. In addition to this, text messages were sent out from Faith's phone, though no one knows for sure if it was Faith who sent them. At 3:40 a.m., a text was sent from Faith's phone to Brandon Edwards, someone she had previously dated. The text read, quote, "Hey B, can you come over here please? Rosario need you much more, aha, you know. Please let her know you care," end quote. 3 minutes later, another text was sent to Edwards that said, quote, "then," end quote, which most people believe was a correction from the previous message where the person had accidentally typed aha, making the complete sentence, quote, "Rosario needs you more than you know," end quote. There was no more activity on her phone other than a response message from Edwards at 4:15 p.m. the next day in which he asks, "Who is this?" Police later examined Rosario's phone records, which indicated that around the time Faith's phone was sending texts to Brandon Edwards, Rosario made several attempted calls to his number. After being unsuccessful at getting an answer, Rosario then placed a call to Jordan McCrary, a Chapel Hill soccer player she knew. At approximately 4:25 a.m., Rosario left the apartment and got into McCrary's car. According to Rosario, when she left the apartment that morning, Faith was asleep in her room. Strangely, Rosario also stated that she left the apartment doors unlocked, which seems like an odd thing to do considering previous instances of break-ins and the knowledge that her roommate and best friend was inside, asleep. According to Rosario, McCrary and she drove to the home of a friend located on West Longview Street and arrived at approximately 4:30 a.m. Rosario spent the night there, and upon waking up the next morning, hung out for a little longer before she began trying to get a ride home around 10:30. She has said that she called Faith several times to try and have her pick her up, but received no answers. Eventually, Rosario called Marisol Rangel, a friend, who drove over and gave her a ride back to the apartment. Though the story varies, with some accounts stating that both Rosario and Rangel entered the apartment together and others stipulating that Rosario entered alone, at approximately 11 a.m., Rosario entered and called out Faith's name, though she got no response. Rosario then went to Faith's bedroom and found her body, covered in blood and wrapped in a quilt. Faith was partially nude. Rosario immediately dialed 911. I will now play this 911 call in its entirety.
11:01 a.m. 44 seconds, September 7, 2012.
Dara 911. Where is your emergency?
I just walked into my apartment and my friend just like going to be unconscious.
Okay, what's your address, ma'am?
I live at Hawthorne at the View.
Give me the address.
I just moved here. I'm about to get it. Oh my God. It's 5639 Old Chapel Hill Road in Durham.
Okay, repeat it to me so I make sure I've got it correct.
Okay. 5639 Old Chapel Hill Road. It's apartment.
Okay, what's
1602.
1602?
Yes.
Okay, what's the phone number you're calling from?
201-321-8075.
Okay, you say your friend is unconscious?
He's unconscious. I just walked in the apartment and there looks like there's blood everywhere.
Okay, listen to me. Somebody's already sending me ambulance. Okay, I need to get some information from you, and I'm gonna tell you how to help her. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. How old is she?
She's 19.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't want to touch her, but
listen to me. Is she breathing?
I don't know.
You need to check and see. Is she breathing?
Kate. I don't think so.
Okay, listen to me.
There's blood everywhere.
There's what?
There's blood everywhere.
Okay.
I don't know what happened.
Okay, is she on her back or is she on her, laying on her stomach?
She's on her back, but, like, I think she fell off the bed because she's, like, off the bed. There's blood all over the pillows, like, in the comforter. I just don't know what happened.
Okay. All right, listen to me, all right?
Is someone coming?
Yes, I've got somebody coming. I need for you to help her. I need for you to go up to her. We need to see if she's breathing or not. Okay?
I don't think so.
Okay. Listen to me. Go up. The paramedics are on their way. I want you to stay on the line. I'm going to tell you what to do next, all right? Are you right by her now?
Yes.
Okay. Listen carefully. She's not moving. Okay.
No.
Will you touch her arm? Tell me, how does she feel?
She's not moving.
Okay, ma'am. We need to find out if we can help her or not. You've got to, do as I'm asking so we can help her. All right?
Okay.
If you can, lay her flat on her back. Remove any pillows.
Lay her flat on her back?
Flat on her back. Remove any pillows.
Okay.
Kneel next to her. Look in her mouth for food or vomit. Okay, kneel next to her, look in her mouth for food or vomit. Tell me something. Listen to me. What is your name?
Karina. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
It's okay, honey. Listen to me.
I don't know.
Okay, all right. Listen to me. When you touch her, how does she feel? Does she feel warm?
No, she feels cold.
She feels cold? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, all right. Don't touch anything else, okay? Don't touch anything else. Okay, they're on their way. I've got police on the way to you, and I've got medics on the way. Okay?
I can't believe this.
Okay. What room is she in?
She's in my bedroom.
Okay, I want you to go back into the living room, okay?
I don't know what's going on.
Listen to me.
In my room that, like, was not here before.
Okay, listen
like
to
someone
me.
Someone that came in here.
Okay.
It really does.
All right, what did
like
you say your name was
came
again?
In here because
okay,
I don't understand.
Okay, listen to me. Don't touch anything else in the room.
I want you
to leave that room, go into the living room. You need to make sure the door is unlocked so somebody can get in, so that the medics and the police can get in when they get there. Okay?
Yes, it's unlocked.
Okay, now tell me again.
They're going to get here, though.
Okay, they're on their way, honey. They're coming as fast as they can. You just stay on the phone with me, all right?
Yeah.
Okay, tell me again what your name is.
It looks like someone has been in there because she's not like the cell. I don't know what
Okay. I've let them know. We've got everybody on the way to help you. Now, tell me again what your name is.
What
is your name?
Karina Rosario.
Karina?
Yes.
Okay, Karina. You sit down on the couch and don't touch anything, okay? You just sit down.
I'm not touching anything.
Okay. I just want you to sit down because the police and the medics are going to be there. They're coming as fast as they can, all right?
Okay.
You just stay on the phone with me.
Okay.
You just stay on the phone with me.
Are you sure they're coming?
Yes, ma'am. They are on their way.
I can't believe this. No, someone had to have been in there.
Okay. We've got first responders on the way. There's a fire truck coming. There's a medic coming. And the sheriff's department's on the way to you.
Okay.
You just stay on the phone with me until somebody gets there with you. All right?
Okay,
Karina. How old are you, Karina?
I'm 20.
You're 20? Okay, hon. You're doing all right. You're doing all right. You just stay on the phone with me.
I see the police.
You see the police?
Yes.
Okay. You let me know when they get in there with you, and then you can talk to them, all right?
Okay.
I just don't want you to be alone right now.
Okay.
You just stay on the phone with me.
Okay.
Are they in there with you? They coming in?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, honey. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
The 911 call seems to corroborate that Rosario was there alone, considering she continually says, "I walked in and not we." Also, there is no apparent conversation between her and anyone else. Interestingly, there is a belief by many that Rosario is in fact not the one who made the call, and that Rangel had made it for her, pretending to be Rosario. This is suggested based on the fact that the caller doesn't identify herself until she is asked multiple times, and that she never says Faith's name, only referring to her as my friend. Others find it odd that she continually pushes the narrative that someone else must have been in the room. It's hard to examine the call, honestly, because as we have seen with 911 calls, it's extremely difficult to know how people will react to a situation like this. Whether or not it was Rosario on the phone, we may never know. Either way, many who have looked at this case find the phone call suspicious. Police were extremely tight-lipped about the investigation, initially, though several years later, a court order forced the release of over 100 pages of police documents and reports which give insight into the investigation, as well as possible suspects, and also lists several search warrants which were executed. Upon arrival, police found Faith lying face up. Her head was hanging halfway off the bed with a pool of blood beneath it. She was naked from the waist down and had on only a black t-shirt, which had been pulled up over her head. In addition to the blood beneath her head, they discovered a large amount of blood splatter on the wall and a closet door indicating the extreme force and violence of the attack. Police also indicated that they found a bloody tampon lying on the bed beside Faith. According to the autopsy report, Faith had been bludgeoned extremely brutally, and her cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. In addition to this, the medical examiner found cuts and bruises on her arms and legs, as well as blood beneath her fingernails. Police also revealed that she had been sexually assaulted, and a rape kit was collected which showed the presence of semen, which also matched male DNA found elsewhere in the apartment. Chapel Hill Police Chief Chris Blue stated, quote, "Investigators have excellent evidence in this case, and we are making a public appeal for any information that will help us tie the evidence to Faith's killer. If the killer is out there hearing this message, know this. We will catch you." End quote. Among other pieces of evidence collected that day were a bottle, which was normally kept in the kitchen, which had tissue fragments and DNA on it. Police also took a Bacardi bottle, a wine bottle, bedding, a remote control, a purple HTC cell phone, pillows, undergarments, a Riesling bottle, tank top, pens, note cards, apartment keys, as well as paperwork from Faith's bedroom and closet. Investigators later released a photo of the Bacardi bottle covered in blood. They believe this was the item used to bludgeon Faith to death. Also found at the scene was a crude note written on a torn piece of a fast food bag from Time Out Restaurant. According to police documents, the note was written in ink and was only three lines, reading as follows, quote, "I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous," end quote. The note was found laying on the bed. The report goes on to state, quote, "Based on preliminary investigation, it is believed that the victim may have been acquainted with the person who killed her," end quote. It has never been revealed whether or not investigators conducted handwriting analysis on the note, though Peggy Walla, a handwriting expert, did look at the note for a news site. According to her analysis, she believes the note was written either prior to the murder or away from the scene, since it did not have any blood on it. In addition to this, she has argued that the writer may have used his or her non-dominant hand in order to try and conceal their identity, which would be why it was so poorly written. One of the more strange details of the note is the fact that it exists in the first place. It was obviously written in reference to Faith, but if the killer had written it, what purpose did it serve to leave the note for someone you knew was already dead? Police immediately constructed a timeline of the previous night in conversations with Rosario, as well as other friends and Faith's family. They proceeded to the Thrill Bar, in which Faith and Rosario had been the night before, and examined the surveillance cameras. According to police documents, quote, "One segment showed four men entering the club together. The one who enters the club first appears to be the same man who exits the club with Faith Hedgepeth. The fourth man also appears near the end of the video footage," end quote. The man seen leaving with Faith would later be identified as David Bell. Unfortunately, much of the reports have the names redacted. However, many of the names have come out over time through investigation by journalists and private investigators. Records indicate that DNA samples were sought from several men who were seen at the Thrill that night, including Jacob Beatley, the man whose apartment Rosario went to that morning, and Reginald Leonard Jackson II, a Greensboro resident who had been exchanging texts with Faith prior to her death. Interestingly, in relation to Jackson, the police reports state that when the officers, quote, "arrived in the parking area of his home, and upon seeing the officers, he turned around in his car and left the area trying to avoid the officers," end quote. The report also states that an officer later spoke with Jackson, who made it clear that he did not want to talk to police and didn't want to be involved in any way. When asked if he knew Faith, he would only state, quote, "I know of her," end quote. In regard to Jacob Beatley, the report reads, quote, "He answered the questions on our questionnaire and also stated that he was at the Thrill during the early morning hours of Friday, September 7th, 2012. Jacob said he drove home after leaving the club, where he stayed for the remainder of the night. I asked him what time he left the club that night, but he couldn't recall," end quote. The report goes on to state that Beatley did not want to submit his DNA to police until he spoke to his father, after which he said he wanted to speak to an attorney. In later correspondence with police, he neglected to submit a sample of his DNA. In addition to Beatley, Bell, and Jackson, it's made apparent, despite redactions, that Eric Jones was among those suspected early on. According to investigators, just hours before Faith was murdered, Jones changed his Facebook cover photo to a picture of a quote, which read, "Dear Lord, forgive me for all of my sins and the sins I may commit today. Protect me from the girls who don't deserve me and the ones who wish me dead today." Police were given permission to search Jones' cell phone and found a text message he sent to a friend the day before the murder, in which he asked for forgiveness for what he was about to do. He also sent out a tweet asking someone else to forgive him. Jones also happened to live in the same apartment complex as Faith and Rosario. Police searched Eric's apartment, as well as his Jeep, but according to investigators, he was extremely cooperative with them. To the surprise of many, Jones submitted his DNA for testing, and it did not match that which was found at the crime scene. When asked later about Faith and the crime itself, Jones stated, quote, "From what I knew of her, she was the sweetest person in the world. If you needed her and she could do it, she was there. I'll be honest with you. Whoever did this deserves to burn." End quote. Police have made it clear that despite Jones's DNA not being a match, they believe he knows more than he is saying and he remains a person of interest. In their investigation, police came upon a very strange piece of information. When they dumped Faith's cell phone records, they discovered that she had placed a call at 1:23 a.m. Considering the time, this would place her at the Thrill Bar, but investigators believe that a glitch in her phone caused the timestamp to be incorrect. The call appears to have been made accidentally, but a voicemail was left, and some believe the call actually took place during the murder, and that the voices on the message are those responsible for the death of Faith Hedgepeth. The voicemail is extremely difficult to understand, but Arlo West, the president of Creative Forensic Services, conducted an analysis of the call and came out with a transcript which he believes is accurate. I will play a small snippet of this audio so you can get an idea of how difficult it is to understand. According to West, there are at least three people present during the attack, two males and a female. Though I'm not going to go through the entire transcript, I do want to cover a few areas which are significant and very disturbing if in fact they are accurate. At the beginning of the voicemail, we hear a female voice ask, "You want to mess with my boyfriend?" To which Faith responds, "I said I don't want to, Rosie." Later, the female voice states, "I'm gonna kick your face, bitch. I figured out that's bullshit." Throughout the call, multiple times Faith exclaims "help" and "ow." Towards the end of the call, there's a discussion about binding her hands and duct tape is mentioned. One of the male voices states, quote, "I'll fuck her," end quote. To which the other male responds, quote, "I think she's dying," end quote. The first male responds back, quote, "Do it anyhow," end quote. You can plainly hear Faith saying, quote, "Get off of me," end quote. West has said that he clearly hears the name Rosie as well as Eric mentioned in the audio. It should be noted, while West has argued that the timestamp is wrong, police have stated that they believe the call came from the bar that night and not during the murder. West argues against this, stating that in the audio you do not hear background chatter, the sound of glasses clinking, or any other audio which you would associate with a bar. When asked about the call, police spokesman Lieutenant Josh McAmore said, quote, "In any kind of homicide, there are thousands of pieces of evidence that are collected. The vast majority are not related to the case. I don't think there was a great need for us to release the audio because the note was the important thing," end quote. Police Chief Chris Blue called the audio garbled and difficult to decipher. He indicated that they believed the note was more useful in their investigation. Roland Hedgepeth, when played the audio, stated, quote, "It's pretty garbled up, but I know my daughter's voice. From day one, I heard my daughter screaming in the background, and I knew something was going on," end quote. The FBI was called in to assist with the investigation, and they developed a profile of the murder suspect. According to them, the man had likely lived near Faith in the past, had expressed an interest in her, and his behavior may have changed since the crime. They believe he may show an unusual interest in the case and may talk about it fairly openly. Unfortunately, this profile developed no new leads or information. Police continued investigating, and though their suspect list existed, it was slowly being whittled down as they were able to rule out multiple people on the basis of DNA. Police went to a judge in November of 2012, requesting that all files be held under seal. Local newspapers began contesting this, and for the next few years, the files remained sealed. A judge officially ordered the records to be unsealed in July of 2014. Desperate and frustrated, police handed over DNA evidence to Parabon Nano Labs in Reston, Virginia. The lab was able to create a computer-generated composite of the suspect based on the DNA retrieved from the crime scene. According to Ellen Graytak, director of bioinformatics at Parabon, The company uses a database of known DNA samples to identify points in the human genome linked to physical traits, and then uses predictive modeling to generate likely composites based on their samples. The company says it is 85.7% confident that the suspect has dark or light olive skin. It is 93.8% sure that the suspect has brown or hazel eyes. The composite depicts a Latino male with olive skin and brown or hazel eyes and black hair. According to Chapel Hill Police Lieutenant Salisa LeHue, quote, "The composite doesn't show such things as a definite body mass index, hairstyle, or age. So you have to take into consideration when you're looking at the photo. Someone who is heavier set would have a different fullness to the face," end quote. When asked why police waited so long to release the composite, LeHue responded, quote, "It was not in the best interest of the case to release that. I can't go into specifics," end quote. She did go on to say that the composite does not rule out the possibility that others were involved. When asked about the composite, Roland Hedgepeth stated that it looked like several men he had been shown photos of by police, though he also stated, quote, "It might look like 500 people out there," end quote. Regardless of the passage of time, the family remained firmly aligned with the Chapel Hill police, who they believe are giving all of their efforts to solving the case. Roland later stated, quote, "I have pretty much an open door with Lieutenant LeHue. She's been very cooperative with the parameters she has to operate in. It seems like they're a little more open to answering questions," end quote. Despite his belief in the efforts of the authorities, Faith's father Roland hired a private investigator to look into the case. Hunter Glass took the case and has been working it pro bono for the past 2 years. Glass believes people close to Faith know more than they're saying, and has made it clear that he's focused on finding out what it is they know. When asked about this, Glass stated, quote, "What people are failing to realize is the longer they sit on information, the more involved they become. The more they become an accessory to a homicide by not coming forward with information," end quote. When it comes down to the investigation, Glass believes that there is a man who should be looked into, an ex-roommate of Brandon Edwards, the man Faith texted and Rosario called in the hours before the murder. According to Glass, Edwards' ex-roommate has a long criminal record connected to assault charges on women. Police have not yet received a DNA sample from this individual. 5 years later, and the identity of Faith's killer remains a mystery. Despite stress and frustration, the Chapel Hill police still firmly believe they're going to solve this case. Chief Blue stated, quote, "We don't think this is a case of if it will be solved. It's when. There hasn't been a day in which our investigators haven't worked on this case, and we won't stop until it's solved," end quote. A number of donators have come forward, and there is currently a $40,000 reward available for information leading to the arrest of Faith's killer. Police have received over 10,000 tips in regard to this case. In total, police have interviewed over 2,000 possible suspects and taken DNA samples from 750 people, both men and women. Rosario has been very quiet since the murder took place, refusing to speak to the media or making any other public statements. But according to investigators, she has been cooperative with them, and they have spoken with her more than 10 times in the years since Faith was killed. So what happened to Faith Hedgepeth? In the 5 years since she was taken away from the world, several theories have risen to the surface. Some have been put out by her family, some by private investigators, others from friends and online detectives. In a case like this, with so many possible suspects and so many different names to look into, it's hard to not have a wide assortment of theories. One theory suggests that Faith was not in fact murdered by someone she knew, but by a complete stranger. According to this line of thought, this unknown spotted Faith at some point in time, be it days before her murder or perhaps even the night of, and followed her home. Once locating her apartment, he sat and watched, waiting for the perfect moment to strike, at which point he saw Rosario leaving and took that as his opening. What his motivation would have been, outside of being a sick killer, is unknown. Could this suggest Hunter Glass is on the right track in looking at Brandon Edwards' ex-roommate? The second theory digs into Faith's past and surmises that an ex-boyfriend or associate may have been responsible. Faith was an outgoing woman who made friends easily. She was a beautiful young woman who attracted men and at the time of her death she was single. She had dated a few men on and off in previous years, and many believe that one of these men may have been responsible for the crime. Despite the fact that police very thoroughly dug into these possibilities, it's never been released whether or not they indicated that a former boyfriend or associate of Faith's could be considered a person of interest. It's almost impossible to know how many people may have come into contact with her who could have felt angry and jealous enough to have committed such a vile act. Another theory dismisses the idea of it being a stranger, or at least a total stranger. Many have examined the details of that night and consider it highly possible that the person or persons involved in this crime may have known Faith, if only socially. This theory follows the line that one or more of the men Faith met with and spoke to that night at the Thrill is responsible for her brutal murder. Many factor in the likelihood of this person having had a few drinks at the club that night, possibly even indulging in some kind of illegal drugs, and felt spurned when his advances on Faith were dismissed. Perhaps this slight, combined with intoxication, could have been enough to send him or her over the edge. One of the more prevalent theories is that Eric Tokoi Jones, Karina Rosario's ex-boyfriend, is responsible for this violent crime. Theories point to numerous facts, including that Jones had previously threatened Faith, sent out cryptic texts and social media posts in the hours before and after the crime took place, was prone to violence as is shown by his past relationship with Rosario, and that he lived in an apartment in the same complex. Although Jones was ruled out as being the man wielding the murder weapon based on DNA tests, many believe that doesn't change the possibility of him being involved. Even police have stated that they believe there's a good possibility that Jones knows more about this case than he has shared with them, despite his high level of cooperation. Outside of, or possibly in connection with Jones, one theory which has gained a lot of traction over the past few years is that Faith's best friend and roommate, Karina Rosario, may either have been directly involved with the murder or possibly knows exactly who was responsible. Many have been critical of her 911 call, believing that she was disconnected and seemed uninterested in helping Faith. In addition to this, we have the note which states, quote, "I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous," end quote. Many believe that there was some kind of an issue between Rosario and Faith, revolving around a man, possibly Brandon Edwards, and that this dispute, when mixed with drugs and alcohol, turned violent. The voicemail that was left behind certainly seems to show that a woman was involved in whatever incident was taking place at that time, be it the murder, or if the timestamp is correct and it was happening when both were at the Thrill. Some believe that Rosario was present when Faith was murdered, and her leaving the apartment that night was to procure an alibi for her whereabouts, while others believe that Rosario was not involved, but was either told, or by some other means, gleaned the identity of the man who murdered Faith. There is even a theory which suggests that the murder of Faith Hedgepeth was done as a warning to Rosario, and that the note was in fact left for her. It's been 5 years now, and for all of these years, Faith's friends and family have struggled with the knowledge of how violently she died. They've experienced the difficulty of not only having to accept that this beautiful, bright woman was taken away, but that her final moments were those of horror at the hands of a cold and brutal killer. Chapel Hill Police Chief Blue, when asked about what the chances are that this case would be solved, responded by saying, 100%. With the abundance of evidence available in this case, they are merely looking for that one piece of information which could tie everything together. Someone knows more than he or she is saying. Until he or she comes forward, or the police manage to get a break in the case to connect all of the dots, the rape and murder of 19-year-old Faith Hedgepeth remains unsolved. The FBI profile stated that the killer likely would be obsessed with the investigation and would read every news article, study every story. He may even be listening right now. Regardless of who is responsible, someone out there has a strong suspicion or knows the name of the person who committed this heinous crime. It may even be you who holds the information and the power to grant justice to Faith Hedgepeth and closure to her family and friends. Faith Hedgepeth was a beautiful young woman, full of potential and on the doorstep of achieving her dreams. She was on target to be the first member of her family to graduate from college, seeking to pursue a career in the medical field or possibly education. She was fun-loving and social, the kind of person that everyone wanted to get to know. She had men fawning over her, and who could blame them? She worked two jobs to support herself, lived in off-campus housing with her best friend, and overcame her struggles with money to get herself back into Chapel Hill. Unfortunately, people can become jealous of someone like Faith, and that jealousy can lead to dark places. Early in the morning hours of September 7th, 2012, someone violently and viciously sexually assaulted and murdered Faith Hedgepeth, snuffing out what could have been a beautiful light in the world. Her family and friends were left shaken and forever changed. There didn't appear to be any explanation, any real motive behind the attacks, and for 5 years the Chapel Hill police have struggled to untangle the web of friends and acquaintances in hopes of tracking down the person or persons responsible. They have DNA evidence which they know belongs to the killer, and yet they've been unable to match it to anyone in particular. Karina Rosario, Faith's roommate and best friend, discovered her body, but since then she's had very little to say, leading many to believe that she knows something more than she's thus far admitted. She spent Faith's last hours with her before leaving to spend the night with a friend. As far as investigators are concerned, Rosario is the last person to have seen Faith alive and may hold the key to solving this terribly tragic case. Before moving into the theories, there's two pieces of evidence from the case that I want to address because they're points of major speculation. First and foremost, Rosario's 911 call that morning. Some have listened to the call and find it to be suspicious, and while I can see their point, it's extremely hard to judge someone's behavior on a call like this. Imagine a young college girl walking into her apartment and finding her roommate and her best friend covered in blood, partially nude, and clearly deceased. To say she would be scared and in shock is putting it lightly. You can tell from the call that Rosario's freaking out. She's crying and can hardly enunciate her words. Many have suggested that it isn't even Rosario on the call, and that instead it's Marisol Rangel. It's impossible to tell, but police time and again have said that they believe the call was made by Rosario. Considering the level of investigation, I'm going to have to agree with them. And though I admit the call is chaotic, it's impossible to judge. We never know how we'll react to something until we're in it, and Rosario's reaction doesn't feel completely out of line to me. Then there's the so-called butt-dialed phone call from Faith's phone. It's nearly impossible to decipher what's being said, and though audio technicians and engineers have worked on creating transcripts, some of it sounds correct to me and other parts I feel are more open to interpretation. It definitely sounds like something bad's going on, and you can certainly hear a woman saying, "Ow," and "Get off me." You can distinctly hear two female voices and two male voices, though understanding what they say is difficult. The police have argued that this took place at the bar earlier that night, while others have said the timestamp is wrong. It's difficult to know who's correct, but based on the way Faith looks on surveillance cameras exiting the bar that night, she doesn't appear to have been accosted and she doesn't act frightened or upset. Many believe this is audio of Faith being attacked and murdered. I honestly don't know. But what I do know is that it's extremely disturbing. I wanted to include the full audio, but I've been unable to find a full cut of it. For the most part, it's just garbled noise. Whatever was happening on that call, whoever it was with Faith, I do believe they hold many answers the police have been looking for. The first theory looks at the murder from an outside perspective. Some have suggested that Faith may have been murdered by a completely random person. A lot of people who support this theory believe that Faith may have been stalked by someone who admired her from a distance, or even someone with whom she may have had mild interactions, possibly even at the Thrill that night. The motive is somewhat thin, though. It's been alleged that the crime may have been sexually motivated and that the murder was secondary, coming as a result of Faith fighting against her attacker, or perhaps even threatening to go to police. We know from the phenotype DNA analysis which generated the composite that this image doesn't appear to match anyone Faith's good friends could identify, which lends credence to the possibility of it being an outsider. In the 5 years since the murder took place, police have never managed to link the DNA to any person of interest. This suggests that whoever committed the crime wasn't inside Faith's circle, and possibly left the area fairly rapidly after committing this crime. Were it another student at Chapel Hill or someone in Faith's day-to-day life, their absence would likely have been noticed and considered suspicious. On the other end of the coin, the FBI brought in a profiler who believes that Faith not only knew her killer, but likely lived near him at some point in time. In addition to this, it seems highly unlikely that the killer just happened to choose a night where Rosario would leave the apartment unlocked while Faith was inside. Then there's the note, which seems to suggest that there'd been interaction between the two. Also, the sheer brutality of the murder leads many to believe that this was a personal attack. To stand just a few feet away from someone, to look them in the eye and savagely assault them with a liquor bottle isn't a detached act. I tend to agree that it certainly seems personally motivated, and that the crime itself suggests a high level of anger. Now, Hunter Glass, the private investigator hired by Faith's father, has pointed his finger at Brandon Edwards' ex-roommate. Unfortunately, there's very little information about him, and police have never discussed whether or not they think he was involved. Whether or not he qualifies as a stranger is hard to say. If Faith did indeed date Edwards at one time, there's a good chance she would have met this man. Though it is possible this crime was committed by someone who, for lack of a better term, may have been a stranger to Faith, I consider it unlikely when weighed against the evidence. In conjunction with this theory, we have the idea that Faith may have been murdered by someone she once knew, and possibly even an ex-boyfriend. There is more to that, I believe. An ex or someone who was close at one point in time with Faith could certainly have more room to develop anger or become jealous of some aspect of her life. Considering what most people believe to be a personal crime, it would make a lot more sense for it to have been committed by someone she had more than just a few conversations with. The problem with this theory is that police believe they did DNA analysis, or at least investigated, almost everyone in Faith's life who spent time around her. There have been no matches, and I'd have to believe that any ex-boyfriends would have been high up on their list of potential suspects. Again, though, I can't help but get stuck on the timing of the crime. The idea that someone knew she'd be alone seems present, though there's no way to prove it. This isn't the kind of thing you can plan out unless you know you're going to have the time to do it. But at the same time, the murder weapon was a bottle from inside the apartment. To me, this suggests that the killer may not have planned to commit the murder. As I previously stated, many believe that sexual assault was the prime motivation, and that makes sense to me. The killer didn't go to the kitchen and get a knife or a wire. He didn't bring a weapon with him. He used what was nearby, which I believe points to the decision to kill Faith being more spontaneous than planned. I certainly believe people from Faith's past should be looked into more closely, and I consider this a more likely scenario than the one of a complete stranger. But I also have to say that I don't think Faith was murdered by someone from her past. Why that night in particular? It just doesn't add up to me. The third theory is one of the more popular theories and follows the belief that Faith was murdered by Rosario's ex-boyfriend, Eric Tecoy Jones. The FBI profiler said that the killer had likely lived near Faith in the past. Jones had actually lived with Faith when he was dating Rosario, and at the time of the murder, he lived in an apartment in the same complex. One of the reasons the FBI believed the killer knew Faith was that he appeared to be familiar with her apartment and the location of specific items. There's also the chilling detail that the killer, having murdered Faith and finding his hands covered in blood, may have actually washed his hands before writing the note, which could be found beside her. This led them to believe that this was someone who was comfortable in the apartment and wasn't worried about getting caught while he was there. If indeed Jones were involved, he would have known the layout of the apartment, having lived there, and would have had a short trip back to his own apartment when he was finished. He may even be familiar with the fact that Rosario would occasionally leave the apartment door unlocked. Jones has a history of violence against women, and it's been reported that he threatened Faith's life on at least one occasion. According to Faith's friend, Marisol Rangel, Faith was frightened of Jones and knew his proclivity for violence. In addition to this, Faith played an instrumental role in the breakup that occurred between Jones and Rosario, and Jones had told her personally that she was responsible for it. Another piece of the profiler's analysis was that the killer would likely talk frequently about the case and study every news article and television hour in which it was discussed. Early on in the investigation, Jones was very outspoken, doing several television interviews before withdrawing from the public. He spoke highly of Faith, though that seems to stand in direct contrast to his opinion about her in private. Here we have, for the first time, someone with violent tendencies who also has a motive. On the investigative side of the case, police would go on to rule Jones out as the killer based on a DNA sample which he submitted. They would also say that he had been very cooperative with them, though they would also say that just because he wasn't the one who performed the murder doesn't mean he isn't hiding something. Police Lieutenant Salisa LeHue said during an interview that Jones remained a person of interest and that this is where the case opens up to other possibilities. Police have theorized that it's entirely possible that Faith was murdered by one man, but that others may have been present. If that's true, it's entirely possible that Jones was there that night, or maybe just happens to know who it was that murdered Faith Hedgepeth. It should be noted that on the infamous voicemail, several transcripts state that the name Eric is spoken a few times. This has led many to believe that the voicemail does connect to the murder itself and that Eric being mentioned is to Coy Jones. Unfortunately, due to disputes over the voicemail itself and a lack of supporting evidence, this can't be known as a fact. Either way, it's a compelling piece of information that the Chapel Hill police have looked into. Within days of the murder, they had search warrants issued for Jones' apartment and vehicle, making it fairly clear that he was high up on their list of suspects. Unfortunately, they never found what they needed to make a case against him, and when his DNA didn't match that found at the crime scene, they were left with little else they could do. His text messages and social media posts in the hours and days prior to and after the murder don't help support his claim of total innocence either. It seems very apparent that Jones was involved in some dark things. His tendency towards violence and involvement with drugs makes him a volatile man, and his previous experiences with Faith certainly make everyone who examines this case suspicious. I do believe that at a minimum, Jones knows more than he is saying. Whether or not he was present during the murder, that's impossible to answer without more evidence. But if he wasn't involved in some way, then he's got a terrible string of bad luck and extenuating circumstances which paint him as a prime suspect. Obviously, based on the evidence, we know Jones didn't swing the bottle that took Faith's life, but I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if he knows exactly who did. That leaves us with the last theory, and one which has grown in popularity in the 5 years since Faith was murdered. According to many, if there's one person who should be more thoroughly examined in the murder of Faith Hedgepeth, it's her best friend and roommate, Karina Rosario. Since the morning she found her friend's body, Rosario has been very quiet. She hasn't done public interviews, she released no statements. Perhaps she was in shock, maybe even heartbroken over the loss of her friend, but her avoidance of the spotlight has led many to believe that she's got something to hide. The Chapel Hill police have stated that over the years they have discussed the crime with her more than 10 times. The only reason I can see that you would continually go back to the same person with questions would be because you have issues with the answers she's given you in the past. 5 years later and the police are still asking you questions? Something doesn't add up there. I've read a great deal of rumor and speculation that Faith and Rosario had a dispute that night over a man, specifically Brandon Edwards. According to phone records, on the morning she was murdered, Faith was texting Edwards while Rosario was calling him. In Faith's texts, she's apparently trying to get Edwards to come visit Rosario. What's strange about it is that Edwards' response to Faith's text is to ask who she is, which to me suggests that her number wasn't programmed into his phone. Most of the time, if you've got someone's number, even someone you don't know very well, you'll put it in your phone, so why didn't Edwards know who was texting him? Some have speculated that Faith wasn't even the person sending those texts and that, in fact, Rosario was using Faith's phone. Is it possible that the jealousy mentioned on the note found at the crime scene has to do with Brandon Edwards? Hard to say for sure. Rosario's movements that night are somewhat suspect, at least in the eyes of those who consider her a likely accessory to this crime. After returning home from the thrill with Faith, the phone calls and texts to Brandon Edwards begin. When there's no response, Rosario turns her attention to Jordan McCrary, a soccer player at Chapel Hill. She succeeds in getting through to him, and he comes by, picking Rosario up at the apartment at approximately 4:25 a.m. According to Rosario, at this time, Faith was asleep in her room, and the apartment doors were left unlocked. I've always found the doors being unlocked to be a really strange thing to do, especially when your friend is inside sleeping. We also have to consider the fact that Rosario and Faith left the thrill that night because Rosario claimed to not be feeling well. Maybe this was just an excuse to get out, but if she was looking to spend her night with someone, why was she so eager to have Faith drive her home? Police wouldn't specify the nature of Rosario's relationship with McCrary. Rosario's gone until the next morning, catching a ride home from Marisol Rangel after repeated calls to Faith go unanswered. She and Rangel arrive at the apartment around 11 a.m., at which point Rosario makes the grisly discovery. On the 911 call, she sounds very upset and is crying and struggling to explain what's going on. The 911 operator asks Rosario to do a few different things to check on Faith to try and help her, and Rosario's resistant. Of course, she is looking at a horribly brutal crime scene, but you'd think you'd want to go and do whatever you could to try and help your friend. That 911 call is the only piece of publicly released information which says much about Rosario's thoughts on the crime. A downstairs neighbor at the apartment complex would later say that after police left, Rosario seemed calm and cool. But it's also possible that the full shock had just set in. What I find most suspicious about that night is the fact that Rosario left the apartment unlocked. To me, this suggests that she knew someone was coming and wanted to grant them access. I've read accounts from police in which they've suggested that Faith and Rosario only had one key to the apartment, so they sometimes would leave it unlocked. But it's an incredibly foolish gesture to leave the apartment open in that way when you know your friend is inside and unable to defend herself. The problem is, no one would know that apartment was unlocked unless someone was going door to door and checking for an apartment to get into. The only other way they would know is if someone told them. There's not enough evidence available to really pin anything on Rosario, but I can't shake the suspicion that at a minimum, she knows what happened, and at a maximum, she facilitated the crime in the first place, but that's all just speculation. The note that was left behind read, "I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous." I've always felt this was written by a woman, and handwriting experts have even stated that the writing style appears feminine. If indeed Rosario and Faith were having some kind of a dispute over a man, this kind of language fits perfectly in line with that. We also have the voicemail, which again can't be corroborated, but many believe that Faith speaks the name Rosie several times on that call, and you can certainly hear an angry woman screaming obscenities and pushing for the abuse that Faith is suffering during the call. Police investigated this angle pretty thoroughly, but haven't said much about whether or not they believe Rosario was involved. Faith's friends and family, on the other hand, have been pretty outspoken that they believe that Rosario knows things she is not telling people, and I'm inclined to agree with them. Her leaving the apartment that night feels strange to me, though it's not necessarily out of the ordinary. It just feels like a way to construct an alibi, and her phone calls to Faith the next day also feel strange. McCrary could drive over at 4 a.m. to pick her up but couldn't give her a ride back the next day. Something doesn't add up to me, and I consider it likely that Rosario has more knowledge of this crime than she has shared. There's also been speculation that Faith wasn't the intended target, and that the note left behind was intended for Rosario. Is it possible that Faith was punished for something Rosario had done? I think this has to be considered, and again, this would open up the door to the possibility that Rosario may have more knowledge about potential suspects. The DNA analysis used to construct the composite of the killer was gained from male DNA that was found on the murder weapon and in the semen that was found inside of Faith's body. This composite depicts a male of Latino descent with dark hair and dark to hazel eyes. The image was shown to friends and family, though none of them were able to connect the image to anyone they knew or that Faith may have known. A private investigator later believed that it could match the ex-roommate of Brandon Edwards, though there's been no new information about that. I'd have to imagine that if they believed he were a possible suspect, they'd have looked into it. The composite doesn't appear to match anyone else they've looked at thus far, and they've been unlucky in every DNA test they've administered. With such an abundance of evidence, it's truly startling to accept that this case has not yet been solved. The murder of Faith Hedgepeth is a tragic story. It's an extremely frustrating case to examine as there seems to be so much information, but all of it leads to dead ends. There's a list of suspects, but the evidence just can't seem to fit any of them. Faith's best friend isn't talking, her ex-boyfriend isn't talking, and police are left to issue pleas to the public for their assistance. Faith's friends and family go through every day struggling with the fact that they don't know why she was murdered or who would commit such a savagely brutal act. Her life was stolen, and for reasons we have yet to uncover. Clearly, there are people out there with the answers, and we can only hope that at some point they come forward or make a mistake and the truth can be revealed. Until that time, the murder of Faith Hedgepeth remains a brutal and violent crime without resolution. If you're interested in finding more information about the murder of Faith Hedgepeth, there are many websites and blogs dedicated to her case. The news program 2020 also featured her story. If you have information about the murder of Faith Hedgepeth, please contact the Chapel Hill Police Department or the FBI. Who do you believe murdered Faith? Tweet me at TraceEvPod email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com or comment in the Facebook group. For those of you who don't know, Trace Evidence has a Patreon page where you can help support the podcast. It's located at patreon.com/traceevidence. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence and invite you to check out the website at trace-evidence.com. You can find links to the Patreon, all social media accounts, as well as places to download and subscribe to the podcast. I'm always eager to hear your feedback, so if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a good rating on iTunes and leave us a review. This will greatly help our reach and bring more attention to the cases we cover. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence. Audio check. 1, 2, check, check.